Hey folks, and welcome to another episode of the Human Centered Design Podcast, this time with someone I hold in the highest regards for their contribution to the world of design. It's Dave Gray, co-author of Game Storming and author of The Connected Company, and one of my favourite all-time books, not just design books, it's Liminal Thinking. Now, this episode was really open and free-flowing, mainly because I think it was recorded quite late in the night for me. So we discuss lots of different topics, but mainly I'm going to cover off some of the main points here. We talk about the power of drawing and visualization, the influence of belief systems on reality, and the importance of finding common ground with those that we're working with. Now, he shares his insights on facilitating workshops and encouraging active participation, something many of us are really struggling with, as well as nurturing creativity and challenging beliefs. And this conversation really highlights the need for trust and open-mindedness. How do we get that in order to drive the meaningful change? So Dave also discusses his experience and how he got his first break, really creating infographics for newspapers, and then teaching others to draw to create that alignment. Now he shares the story of starting his company, Explain, and the power of information visualization. Dave's incredible. This is a great episode. We really stress and the importance of creativity and design and the challenges that the notion that only some people are creative, something that I face many times when I'm training. Now, he introduces the concept of being a possibilitarian and encourages testing assumptions and pushing boundaries. Dave also discusses his new endeavor, the School of the Possible, a community that you might be interested in as it explores creative projects and cultivates positive possibilities. It's an incredible episode. Dave's incredible. How many other words can I say to describe this episode? Go grab a coffee, a slice of your favorite cake, or maybe a few biscuits. Sit back and enjoy. Let's get into the episode. Dave, how would you describe what you do and have done over the last 20 years?
20 years in a sentence?
Just give it in 20 words.
I like to use my creativity and imagination to find interesting and less traveled pathways.
Yeah.
I guess that's how I would describe it, yeah.
And I think that's a pretty decent summary, like, you know, because from the outside in, like, we've never spoken before, folks. So I've been a fan for quite a while, a Game Storming era. And kind of like there's a bit behind all of this stuff. Like, there seems to be a common thread through it. And I have my perception of what the common thread is. And I'd like to understand what your common thread is between, say, game storming into liminal thinking, into connected company. What underpins all that for you?
Yeah, excuse me. I would say there is a common thread. And it's like, it's not evident looking forward. It's more evident looking back, as Steve Jobs famously said. But I think it's like sort of pretty early on, I learned that drawing was a really incredible tool for thinking and learning and kind of feeding and fueling your imagination. And I can go all the way back to grade school where, you know, I would try and draw what the teacher was talking about. They weren't drawing for me, but I would try and interpret what they were saying and try and draw a picture of it. And I quickly discovered that my picture was always wrong. Mm-hmm. And but I also discovered that if I went up to the teacher with a picture, they might not be able to create a drawing, but they could fix a drawing. Yeah. And I was, in a way, even very early on, was teaching my teachers how to teach me or something like
that. Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, I was forcing them into a visual realm by saying, okay, this is what you said. No. But, and then they would pick up and that would.
Yeah.
So there's that's this kind of magical discovery that I've been applying my whole life in various ways that, so the number one, people don't naturally teach in this way or explain their ideas visually, but, I have a very strong visual. I need to make abstract ideas concrete. If you're Plato and you're going to talk about abstract philosophy, that's not as helpful as being able to describe a cave, you know, people chained inside the cave and looking at the shadow. Now I can see, now I can imagine that it's a way of taking an abstract idea and making it concrete, and drawing is another way to do that. Storytelling, drawing, whatever, but creating the metaphor or the visual concept that encapsulates the idea. And then the part of that whole magical thing is drawing. Part of it is sharing and having a conversation. And there's a third part, which I learned later, which is there's an artifact that's created in that process that can be useful to other people later. So it's almost like, you know, all the interpretation and the work that I had to go through to figure out how to take this abstract concept I was hearing from a teacher and trying to articulate it into a picture, with a little extra annotation, that's just kind of like inserting the conversation part of it, you know, putting some words into it, can become a really powerful learning tool. Absolutely. And that's pretty much what my whole life has been about, exploring this idea of taking quest. Information and using using information and landscape, mashing up information and landscapes into these kind of information landscapes, which can be used to make whatever abstract idea tangible, concrete. Absolutely. You can walk around in a garden instead of trying to manipulate a bunch of abstractions in your head, you can landscape a mountainside with all this information in it, and you can walk through it mentally.
Absolutely. Like, I think having that draft of how you're seeing it, your version of reality, and how it compares to other people's realities, like, is super, super powerful. And I mean, I don't know if you're aware of just how much of an impact some of your work has had, like, in the change making world. Like, I call designers, service designers, UX designers, researchers and stuff. If you say Dave Gray, liminal thinking is synonymous with that. Wow. So it really is, like, we've launched a new community in the last couple of days, and there's like, I think there's definitely 100 people in there already. And I was like, hey, I'm speaking to Dave Gray tonight, any questions? And there was a couple of people responding to me, DMing me. So they know straight away, like, you know, and they're still kind of, I think liminal thinking is still provoking, which is great, like, you know.
Yeah. And that's another story. There's a story there that's about, you know, again, comes down to following your nose.
Yeah.
You know, like every problem that you kind of solve, you know, is upstream from that is another problem that's even more interesting. And like, so solving the problem of visualizing and explaining complex information leads to the next problem, which, okay, now everybody understands this. Why aren't they changing their behavior?
That's
so
definitely
everybody understands it, but they're not doing it. So now what's the next question is, what is it that's keeping them, even when you understand something that's important for you to do your job well, and even for you to keep your job, people still wouldn't do it.
Yeah. I think that's definitely true for, say, complicated problems.
Yeah.
When it comes to complex problems and complexity, in my experience, it tends to be a lot more of emergent practices and a lot more kind of methods like you're talking about, like, you know, that break the standard convention of the workplace. So bringing a pen, like, this is how I'm thinking, like, I'm still kind of, apparently I'm old school, because I have a pencil in my hand for most of the day.
I have one of those. That's a Statler Mars. I recognize it.
this is my little, when I'm cold, people
are
like,
I have one of those too.
You know, when Jerry's thinking, this is my prelude to whenever you're finished, I'm going to start drawing.
Well, so I'm really thrilled that liminal thinking is coming up in change context, because it was had up until the point where I wrote that, I had been focusing on clarity, and but clarity is only part of the change equation. It's clarity doesn't inherently in itself. I mean, we all know, even the people who are in denial about it, I think, know the earth is warming. The climate is changing. I don't think it's a lack of understanding. It's like, you know, it's like you almost have to have a flat earth kind of mentality to believe that, you know.
Yeah.
And like my dad, who died not long ago, but he was a climate change denier. And I remember asking him, why is it so important for you to believe that this is wrong?
Yeah.
Why do you even care? Well, so number one, he didn't even skip a beat because he knew exactly why it was important for him to believe it. And it wasn't because it was a fact.
Yeah. Tell us, what was the response? What was the response?
It had to do with jobs. I don't remember specifically, but you know, that they're trying to take jobs away.
Okay.
You know, it was threatening people's jobs. And
would you say that's a belief system then that he held on to?
I would say that 90% of everything that we are all doing all the time is beliefs. I mean, almost everything is.
Yeah. Because you actually, like, I've read many, many research books and, you know, working as a UX practitioner and a service designer, but your articulation of belief systems and reality, I'd love to talk to you a little bit more around that, because
that kind of
crystallized a lot of the stuff.
I would love to talk about that. I was just thinking about, in fact, I was just in a thing with Mike just before this, and we were talking, he was talking about beliefs. I think there's, so 90% of the time, most of the time, I think most of us, we're walking around, we're not actually operating with the world as it is. We're operating with our belief system as kind of an intermediary, which, you know, shortcuts a lot of things. We don't have to interpret every single thing we see as something new. Yeah. You know, I don't have to figure out what a lamp is to turn it on, you know, but it's important, I think, to recognize in the same way that, like, when you watch a movie, it's not real. When you read a book, it's not real. Most of the time, the way your mind is operating in the universe, you're not actually dealing with reality. You're manipulating your belief systems and they react the way you expect them to react. Yeah. But there's a difference between believing and being in the world. And it's actually not that easy to just be in the world without, you know, your belief systems are like a filter. Yeah. It's almost impossible to remove them unless you're, you know, really good at meditating or, you know, it's like, you know, we both have glasses on and we're not seeing the glass. We're not seeing the glasses most of the time.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, we're not even feeling them on our face most of the time, but they are changing reality to conform better with our brains. And you know,
so there's kind of a common thread that I can see from the work at GameStorming into liminal thinking, in terms of wanting to provide the stimulus and the kind of the environment and the contextuality to get a better outcome. With liminality and belief systems, the work in GameStorming is going to challenge those belief systems and hopefully unpack opportunities to kind of, you know, redesign or, you know, rethink how those social structures are kind of have been built. What advice do you give to people who are working in those kind of roles at the moment? Either.
Well, I mean, number one, if you're working in one of those roles and you haven't been laid off, you're lucky.
Yep.
So I know, the first piece of advice is appreciate your job, appreciate your boss, hang in there.
True.
Like, be grateful that you have a job. In this environment that we're in.
I know everything's changing, but in terms of when we understand the belief systems, and when we've identified them through reading liminal thinking, now available at all your bookshops now, folks, avoid from buying from amazon.com if you can. But once they've read the book and they understand what we're talking about here in terms of belief systems and how it alters your reality, and my reality and your reality now are two different things. when you land on that and you accept it, what advice do you give to people taking the step beyond that to try and get common ground?
Well, yeah, common ground is it's the grease that, you know, greases the wheels of progress in so many ways
and change.
Yeah. I'm reading this book about trade. I forget what it's called. The Splendid Exchange is what it's called. It's a history of trade. And he is talking about the time in which the Dutch East India Company was formed, and the English were forming also an East India Company at the time. And they were the first corporations. They did a lot of terrible things. But in the context of what is interesting to me is, in the Netherlands, there was already a huge amount of trust in the culture and the society, trust in, because it was one of the first, it wasn't really a kingdom. It was a bunch of kind of principalities that came together and united to fight against the king of Spain or Portugal. I forget which, but they were this little Protestant group of people that resisted the Catholic emperor, I guess, at the time. So they had come together, and there was a bunch of things. Number one, they had to form their own government. So it was the first kind of like united kind of government the second thing is they had to reclaim their land. It was mostly swamp and ocean, and they really had to work together, speaking of common ground, in order to even like reclaim farmland from the ocean. They really had to work together, and they had to loan money to common projects and stuff. So in the process of figuring all that out, you know, finding their way as a nation, you know, figuring out how to do things democratically and together, when it came time for them to invest in the spice trade and other things, they had a major advantage over England. They got there way quicker because they had trust. They had of governance and finance that they trusted. Interest rates were 4% in the Netherlands, and they were 10% in England. And also, a Dutch person would be investing in like a fleet of 12 ships, and the English would be, well, okay, we're going to invest, you know, okay, I'm investing in the ships, but I own the stuff that goes on the ship. And then they had to kind of try and it was much more kind of micromanaging the whole system on the English side, because there just wasn't a lot of trust. And they also had this queen that they didn't really trust either. I think it was the queen, didn't pay her debts very often. She would default on debts a lot. So that made their interest rates higher. And so when you're a Dutch person, you know, your dollar, you know, you get a lot more return on your dollar when you're investing in a corporation than when you're an English person. You get you can get 250 ships for the price of, you know, that the English people could get 80 ships and the Dutch people could get 250 for the same amount of money.
Right.
So, you know, like you're asking about common ground. What do you do with that? Well, I think the number one thing to think about is, sorry for the digression.
No. I love the digressions. This is where the meat and the bone is.
But so trust is a huge part of it. And the way that people build trust is by doing things together, by being in the same boat, by recognizing that they have a threat or a problem that they can only resolve together. I think if you're able to recognize your beliefs for what they are and other people's beliefs for what they are, then there's nothing stopping you from suspending your disbelief, just like in a movie, adopting even a strange, weird, or absurd belief for a period of time in order to, you know, try and see the world the way this other person sees the world. Their experiences are different than yours. You don't necessarily have to agree with someone to try and see their point of view and see their perspective on it and try to understand it. Mm-hmm. There was a really great kind of experiment that happened in St. Louis, actually. I think it was in the 60s or the 70s.
Great city. It's a great city. Around. Dave, hold it together, man. We have listeners around, in St. Louis.
This is not a light topic. It was around abortion. And there were somebody reached out to somebody across the political aisle and said, hey, we disagree about this issue. And but can we try and figure out what we can do as far as common ground? And they got together. And one of the rules of they had a little bit of rule binding, which was, one side listens to the other point of view, and then they have to re-articulate it back, say what you heard. Mm-hmm. And then the person who you're reflecting back to has to agree that, yeah, that's, you understood my point of view.
So you're
in a position now of like, okay, you're in a conflict situation. You're trying to work through it. People are there, hopefully, because they want to. But before you can be heard, you have to show that you have not only heard, but understood from that person's point of view that they feel heard.
It's a really powerful one. Yeah, yeah.
Well, so what happened? They didn't come to, nobody really changed their mind on the abortion issue. But they did find that they had common ground in this area of child welfare. Both sides found that they had a shared interest and passion and emotional connection to for kids who were born into difficult situations to try and make sure that they were given the best chance they could have. So that was something that they found they could work, that not only could they agree about, but they could work together on. And the outcome of that story was that it wasn't that there, I don't know that there was a political outcome so much as the people had something that they could build common ground on, they could work together on, and got to know and like each other. I think that's kind of one of the problems that we're having. I think social media has created a lot of divisions because it's easier to be in rooms where everybody kind of agrees with you.
Yeah, it's an echo chamber.
Yeah, it's easier to find echo chambers. I think so that's part of like the power of if you can get people in the same room together and they do have, kind of rifts or divisions. Well, the one thing you can do is start just getting them to hear each other.
Yeah. It's really, really powerful. Can I just go right back to a little bit?
Yeah.
When you enter the room and say you're facilitating a workshop or something, one of the challenges that I see when I'm training is people kind of go, here's the creative person. They're going to start doing the creative lifting, and we're going to feed into that process. And it's the reframing of that scenario to say, well, look, I'm the facilitator here. I'm just the grease. How do you handle that in your experience, in your career? Because a lot of the thread here is creativity. What advice do you give to people who are in that scenario?
Well, I don't have, I mean, I'll tell you, I had that experience. I was working in Spain.
Yeah.
There was a Spanish consulting firm. My job was to get in and help them. And I started to facilitate in the way that I'm accustomed to. And one of the guys just literally said to me, whoa, wait a second. You want me to do the work? You're the consultant. You're supposed to do the work.
What did you say to that?
I don't remember. I think I just said, okay, well, I guess you're not the right customer. I guess,
Right.
Because
isn't that how it's going to work?
If you want to hire someone to do the work, then that's not the kind of consulting that I.
Yeah.
It also, 100%. I would say, if you're not willing to do the work, then you're doomed. You deserve.
Yeah, you're doomed. You are quite possibly about to fail.
I think it sounds a little flip. Obviously, you can't always choose the customer, but if you're in that situation and they want you to do the work, then I suggest you do the work or tell them to fuck off.
Yeah, pretty much. But in the scenario where they believe that they are not creative, and for me, design is not a creative exercise. It's not.
Okay? Well, if people don't believe they're creative, there's lots of ways to get them over that if they want to get over it.
Yeah. So most of the time, people I'm training, they're there for a reason.
Yeah.
They're interested. They have that ceiling of curiosity. And I guess reframing that initial question, like, how do you provide the nourishment for that seed to blossom?
So this is also going to be a little bit of a digression into a story.
Let's do it, Dave. I'm ready. I'm going to take a drink.
My background, I told you what I did when I was a kid. I would draw pictures to try and understand things. And I learned that the pictures then became these useful kind of information learning artifacts. My first office job was in a newspaper. I was doing exactly that. You know, I was making infographics for the newspaper. Anything from there's going to be a parade this weekend, let's show people where, what streets it's going to go down, to, explaining how the fishing boats work, or how, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Just about anything. My job was to make that stuff visual, how to cook, how to make a stew, whatever. It didn't matter. How to spot skin cancer. I remember that one very specifically. The ABCDs. If you have a mole that's asymmetric, has border irregularity, color variation, and a strange diameter, see your doctor. But
very cool.
So I'm also kind of become this repository of all these strange, trivial pieces of information like that, because once you draw them,
you found your new home, Dave. This is your home on this podcast, because that's all I do.
Anyway, once you draw something, you're not going to forget it. And so I had built this whole company around newspapers. I left the newspaper business, but I believed in information visualization, information landscapes. Yeah. I started a company called Explain. We developed a whole methodology, for lack of a better word, a whole system approach for discovering problems, visualizing them, you know, getting information. And the process was such that there was a facilitator who was asking questions, there were experts in the room providing answers, and there was an artist in the room drawing the pictures and synthesizing them into a picture. This is how the system worked. Well, one day the system broke because the artist was sick, and my job was to be the facilitator. And I was trying to figure out, okay, I can draw, but I didn't want to. I wanted to focus on the facilitation role. Yeah. So I decided to teach the customer how to draw their own pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the very answer powerful to your question. It's like, and I've actually do have a link I can share with you where I put all this stuff online, but within a pretty short period of time, I was able to get them over the hump of, oh wow, oh my God, I can draw. I know how to draw. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily so they could like put their stuff on a museum wall, but enough to be able to think. And so within, I spent about 15 or 20 minutes to give them the drawing lesson. And then, I said, now draw the problem. And, lo and behold, their pictures were about 100 times more creative than I or the artist that would have been there that day would have come up with. They were 1,000 times better because you can draw a landscape of something you know better than I can, even if I'm a really good police sketch artist. You know, I'm good at asking questions and kind of trying to would like this, like this, like this. But if I can teach you how to draw that, you can draw the guy. It's the guy who mugged me.
What are your thoughts, Dave, on the word creativity and how it relates to design? Do you think it's a positive or a negative, or how do you see it?
All right. Well, I mean, so to me, creativity is it's a very clear characteristic of being a human being. you know, we don't really have a lot of tools. We don't have a lot of claw. We don't have claws, big teeth. We don't have a lot of tools. We're a very generalist kind of species. You know, we're not, you know, our main tool is our brain and our creativity and our ability to, you know, you put a person in a room or you put them in the woods and they'll figure out what to eat, probably. And we'll figure out what
to build shelter. I mean, too often it gets wrapped up in the whole kind of sense of like, oh, you're so creative. You made your own card for a birthday and like, you must be very creative. Or, you know, you've got big funny glasses and you've got no hair. You must be a creative. That's the kind of stuff that gets thrown back at me. And it can be sometimes, you know, an educational piece when you speak to people and say, like, actually everyone can be creative. Like it's not just a case of I went to design school and I do design day in, day out. A lot of people seem to fall into the buckets of I'm just not creative. I'm not a creative person, a label they give themselves. So I think the work, especially liminal thinking, I keep coming back to that. And the game storming and a lot of the visualization stuff that you've done over the last decade, that kind of work looks to kind of challenge that kind of convention an awful lot, like, you know, really open up the minds to become, you know, more creative, trying to get those people who challenge their belief systems, who I'm not creative, to becoming creative. Would that be a fair assessment?
I'm just making a, is there a chat in here that I can, okay.
Yeah, there's a chat there. You can throw it in here.
I'm going to share this link with you because, I have made a little free visual thinking school that anybody can take. And the first exercise, which I got from a friend of mine named Chris Glynn, is called Squiggle Birds.
Oh, I've seen this.
It's the first thing that I do when I'm trying to show people how creative they can be is just have them make squiggle and turn them into birds. And
Dave, I've stolen this.
This. There you go.
And I've actually used it.
There you go.
How many? I'd say it was 2015, 2016.
Why don't you use that with people who say they're not creative? Because that's the tool that I use for that.
That is true. That is true, actually. This is the duck one. You do a squiggly shape and then you put a little beak on it.
Could be anything. Yeah. Could be birds. Birds are fun, but it could be anything, you know. It's like looking at, you know, if you're creative enough to look at a cloud and see Mickey Mouse or a crocodile or whatever, then that's your human being.
That's good enough.
You know,
have you seen?
And that's what I call create. You know, creative is simply the act of bringing something new into the world that wasn't there before. If you have a baby, you're creative.
Yeah.
If you have, you're creative. You're creating something that is more than the sum of its parts.
A creator. This is kind of probably a better way to describe
creator. We are all creators, aren't we?
Yeah, as opposed to the creative.
You create your living room. I think I'm sure that people mean it as a compliment when they say that to you. Maybe you don't take it that way, but I think they mean it as a compliment, and they're self-deprecating for whatever reason. But if you feel like at some level they're shirking.
What advice do you give to me, Dave? Beat them up? Is this?
Then I would say, you know, you can like simply just look around at their life and point all the things that they've created.
Yeah, that's true. I thought you were going to say something different there. Look at all their life and point at how crap it is.
No, just point out all the things that they have created and
absolutely.
And say, you know what? If I lit a fire under you, you'd find a way to put it out or get away from it, I bet.
The liminal thinking was 10 years old. Is it 10 years old? No, eight or 9 years old.
Just about, yeah, it is. It was published in 2016, so it's, I was probably, I was writing it about 10 years ago, just about.
Yeah. So over the last 10 years, there's been Explainer, and now you're looking at the school of the possible. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
So tell us all about this, because I'm on the newsletter as well and, you know, I'm following kind of the journey that you've been going on. tell us, he takes a drink of his tea. He's like, here I go. I'm about to do the pitch. Tell us.
I'm waiting for the question.
Tell us all about the School of Possible, Dave.
Well, it's just the same as the first, when you first asked the question, you know, what if I look back over the last 20, 30 years, what have I been doing?
It's this.
I've been, the name for it that I have now for it is I've been practicing the art of the possible, the art of the, what is the most, out of all the possibilities that are in front of me right now, can I see ones that other people might not see? Can I see possibilities that will get me closer to the ideal vision of the life that I want to live than what everyone else is pointing to, you know? And like some of it is simply just like, this may sound like common sense, but when I articulate it, it's going to sound like common sense, but it's not common. You know, I was working at the newspaper. I wanted to get a teaching job. I thought, I went to see some guy give a lecture and I was like, oh wow, this guy gets paid. It's his hobby. It's a very obscure thing about Roman friezes, like bas relief on the side of Roman. And I thought it would be interesting, but it was boring as hell. But I realized the guy is getting paid. This is his hobby. He's kind of really interested in this thing.
Yeah.
No one else is interesting, but they have to go to his class to graduate, whatever. My infantile mind was like, I could do that. You know, he gets paid to do his hobby.
Yeah.
And so they were having an art educators convention in Seattle that year, where all the art teachers and the art schools were coming in or they were going to be hiring. And I remember I said to couple of my art friends, you know, I think I'm going to try and I want to get a, see if I can get a teaching job. And like one guy who was a teacher, and these are all men, unfortunately, one guy was like, well, Dave, we get 300 applications for every position. And another one of my friends was like, there's no way you can get one without a master's degree. You don't have a master's degree. You don't even bother. And so
I've heard this. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing that's common sense is like, what's more expensive in terms of my time, energy, and money to test that assumption or to go get a master's degree? Well, obviously it's much easier for me to apply for a job and see. It's an experiment.
Yeah.
It's not that hard. I mean, even applying to get into school for a master's degree would be almost as difficult as applying, even more difficult than applying for a job.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, okay, all right, maybe so, but I'm just going to act like an idiot for a little while and just try it and see. And lo and behold, I did get a teaching job. Not the one I expected. I accidentally applied to Washington University School of Art, which was in St. Louis. And I thought I was applying to a job in Washington State where I lived at the time. I lived in Seattle.
You're joking. You're joking me.
By the time I got to the job interview, I was like, oh yeah, I would have to move. That's how I ended up in St. Louis, Jerry. That's the story.
Really?
Yeah.
30 years later.
30 years later. Yeah. So like anyway,
Dungeons and Dragons.
It was like the common sense thing is when you're faced with stuff like that, instead of agreeing with what I might call the limiting belief, the boundary, instead of saying, okay, well, someone says the boundary's there, I guess I trust them. There must be a boundary there that I can't cross, or a moat or a canyon that's too big for me to cross. You know, sometimes if you just do the math
challenge,
it's easier to just test the assumption, test it, test on the boundary. And I mean, that hasn't always served me well in every aspect of life, absolutely. But in the main, I mean, sometimes, you know, you poke at a boundary and somebody gets really upset
pokes you back.
Who knows? Yeah. If you're going to be in the habit of testing boundaries, you've got to be ready for some kind of occasional flare up kind of reactions. But in the main, I think it's just served me really well, you know, just being able to poke at the assumptions about reality and just doing the math. Okay. So what's, you know, how much time and energy am I going to invest in this absurd idea, well, maybe it's worth, I do a sketch and I post it on LinkedIn just to see.
Absolutely.
You know?
And you have on your LinkedIn, you're a possibilitarian.
Yeah.
Which I was like, it's a great word. Is this really what you're hoping to make more of with the School of the Possible?
Yeah. School has a lot of meanings, right? School can be a place of learning. School can be a community. School could also be a shared idea or a philosophy that a group of people share, a school of thought. And I didn't come up with the term possibilitarian, by the way. I got it from my friend Greg Petroff. And then I also found that Norman Vincent Peale wrote about possibilitarians back in the early, I don't know, maybe 100 years ago or something.
Yeah.
But I do love it, and I do encourage anyone to adopt it. I don't, you know, once someone asked me not long ago, hey, how would you feel if I changed my LinkedIn to say possibilitarian? Would you feel like I was, I'm like, no, I would love to see everybody on LinkedIn calling themselves a possibilitarian because it means something to me as much as, you know, as much as your religion or your politics mean something to me. Possibilitarian is it's a big idea. It's a big idea that pokes at the nature of reality and the nature of belief, and suggests, I think, that if you can suspend your disbelief, then all kinds of realities become open to you. All kinds of possibilities become available to you that wouldn't be available if you allowed the limiting beliefs of your society, your team, your organization, your culture, or your context, if you allowed them to prescribe, or, you know, to be the boundaries of your reality, you're missing a lot.
Sure. One of the things that I've heard from my coaches is the required resilience needed to work in the space of where you're constantly sort of facing those non-possibilitarians, the people who see the antithesis of the sort of the anti-version of the possibilitarian. Can I ask you, with the work of Mike Parker in liminality and leaning into that, and even the Pomodoro liminality kind of approach of just having regular breaks, how has that worked for you? What behavior has it changed for you? Like, how has it helped you?
Well, if you think about your reality as like a landscape, you can think about it as a scary forest. You can think about it as a rocky uphill path. I think it's helpful to think about it as a garden. Think about your reality as going like and your friends, you know, your acquaintances, some of them might be like weeds, you know, you need to prune.
Yeah.
You know, you need to like do some weeding in your social circles maybe a little bit, or, you know, some weeds might be so pervasive that you can't quite eliminate them, but you can find ways to make them less pervasive in your life. I do think that, you know, the company you keep is important. You know, like everyone has friends, and their friends will lie to you in lots of different ways. Friends will lie to you and say that they like stuff that you did when they don't, because they want to spare your feelings.
Yeah.
Oh, what a nice jacket you chose today, or whatever. You know?
Yeah.
Friends will also lie to you because they're jealous. They don't want you to be successful. Friends will lie to you because, well, if you quit smoking, then I'll have to quit. You know, so you'll have, if you quit drinking, then what am I going to do? Who am I going to go drinking with?
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, so friends will lie to you for all kinds of reasons. Okay. Now, this is where I think, you know, when you think about cultivating your garden of your reality, one of the most powerful, beliefs that I have ever discovered is the belief that you can create customers. And not necessarily be looking for a job, but be, even if it's a job, be thinking about people as customers, because customers don't lie to you.
Yeah.
If a customer is frustrated, if a customer is not, if you're a cook and they don't like the meal, a customer, your friend might pretend to like it. Your customer is not going to pretend anything. They're going to be telling. So
yes. I'm not paying for this.
Yeah. So let's say you want to be a possibilitarian and you have a lot of negativity around you, right? Start spending time with people who are willing to pay you to be around them. You're going to find that you're going to learn a lot. You're going to learn a lot about what things you're doing that people like and don't like that you wouldn't learn from your friends. You're going to learn a lot about what's possible that you wouldn't learn from your friends. Go to those places where people have no particular reason to like you. They're not related to you. They didn't grow up with you. They have no reason to like you, and figure out what you have that can make them happy are going to be the key. And so over time, if you practice that, you practice really not just being selfish about I want to do this because I want to do it and it makes me happy, but I want to do this because I enjoy it, but I also, because other people get value out of it. If you start to approach your life this way, now you're planting seeds in your garden, not just weeding away negative things. Now you've got actual fruits and strawberries Absolutely. And peaches and beautiful things growing in your garden that taste good. Now, it's easier to weed out the weeds because you have something that is positive. So, I think you can spend a lot of energy, waste a lot of energy just trying to remove the negativity. If you have something positive that you can cultivate and grow, then you're just going to naturally fill that space. And 100%. Eventually, you're the people who are you're going to figure out when your friends, what the real motivations are between your friends saying they like something or they don't think it's possible for you or whatever. You can take those things with a grain of salt. And I think it's very easy to get, let your social environment, define the parameters and the beliefs and the boundaries of your existence. And I don't want to be over dramatic, but I think that can lead to depression and even death.
Yeah.
Death of the spirit, definitely, anyway.
We had Hector Garcia, who wrote The Journey to Ikigai, who's based in Tokyo, on the podcast a couple of months ago. And aligning to your purpose is something that I truly believe is really, really important. But he had a really interesting statistic that people who retire without any purpose are, I think it's 65% more likely to suffer heart disease and serious health implications a number of years later. So what you're talking about there resonates very much with me. I know the listeners as well, because Hector's episode was one of the most listened to episodes last year. But Dave, we're actually coming towards the end of the episode. We could speak for another two.
Easily.
I'm going to have to get you back on this podcast, Dave. See, this is what I said to you earlier on. You've found your new tribe. This is the kind of SHIT we love in this podcast. These digressions, as you call it.
Mm-hmm.
When is the School of Possible? I know you're doing stuff with Mike at the moment, but what's the next couple of months looking like for the School of Possible, and how can the listeners at This Is HCD find out more and get more involved with what you're doing?
There's a super easy way, and it's free and it doesn't cost anything except time. And that is, every Friday I host a Zoom call. Anyone who considers themselves a possibilitarian or potential possibilitarian is welcome to join. It's every Friday. It's from 9 to 10:30 Pacific time, which in GMT is 5 to 6:30 PM on Friday. So it's like happy hour. So right after work, if you feel like it,
in the pub.
It's kind of like if there was a church of possibilitarian. We get on the call, we spend 90 minutes. There's no agenda other than what's inspiring you right now. What's fueling your creative energy? What are you working on that's really fun and interesting? And it could be a personal project, could be professional. But we kind of hang out and get to learn about each other's creative projects. And I always leave energized and inspired, and wow, people, lots of people doing really cool stuff. And I think there's, this goes to your point of, you know, a big part of what you believe is possible comes down to who you're surrounding yourself with,
yeah,
who you're spending time with. And possibilitarians tend to create possibilities, and also, you know, as they're exploring possibilities, possibilities build into more. It's like a tree that just branches into more and more possibilities. And people connect on projects. They meet each other there, and then they go off and then they create something together. Or like, oh wow, you're doing that and I'm doing this, and wow, what happens if we put those together? And lots of that kind of stuff.
That's brilliant. It's brilliant. Can they find information on the website about that?
I'll give you the link. Yeah.
I'll put that into the show notes. Dave, I wrap up every episode by thanking the guests for their time and their energy and their vulnerability of coming on and having a free-flowing conversation, because not everyone enjoys being put on the spot and being recorded and have a camera shoved in their face for whatever, like 50, 60, 70 minutes. But we'll definitely have to have you back on in the next couple of months, Dave, because we can talk for a long time about a lot of this stuff. But best of luck with the School of the Possible. And yeah, absolutely fantastic speaking with you. Thanks so much.
Likewise. Thank you. All right.